Welcome to a Khatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Khatra AI.
Okay, let's unpack this. We were diving deep into J.D. Salinger's, well, his singular masterpiece, The Catcher in the Rye. And I think to really appreciate this story, you first have to understand the person behind it, Salinger himself.
Absolutely. He was maybe the most enigmatic, reclusive figure in modern American literature. It's kind of amazing.
His whole legendary reputation rests almost entirely on just this one novel.
It really is fascinating. And his reclusion, you know, his complete withdrawal from public life, it sort of mirrors the alienation we find right there in his main character.
That's a great point.
And that alienation, it seems crucially born from pretty profound trauma. Salinger was a soldier in World War II.
Right. D-Day, Battle of the Bulge, really heavy combat.
Exactly. And that firsthand experience with, well, the horrors of war, it deeply informed his themes, don't you think? That painful gap between innocence and the adult world.
And the total disgust with superficiality, with phoniness.
Yeah, that's it. That trauma, recognized or not, kind of became the psychological blueprint for Holden Caulfield.
So when the book came out in 1951, critics saw this fresh, authentic voice immediately. But it wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms everywhere.
Yeah, definitely not. The profanity, the frank discussion of, you know, teen sexuality. It was instantly controversial.
Literary dynamite, really.
It really was. Banned in schools all over the place, constantly. But at the same time, it became this huge bestseller.
And a symbol for the counterculture, for that whole post-war generation.
Mm-hmm. It takes the form of a building's romance, you know, a coming-of-age story.
Right.
But it's almost subversive.
How so?
Well, it uses that structure to show a character actively, almost desperately resisting growing up. He doesn't want to come of age.
And here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Our focus today is trying to understand these few tumultuous, really agonizing days in the life of 16-year-old Holden.
Right.
And the whole thing is told retrospectively. He's narrating this from, well, some kind of sanatorium or mental institution.
Which is key. The frame tells you a lot.
It does. So the real story isn't just the physical journey through New York, is it? It's that excruciating internal conflict, his fight against what he calls phoniness.
Holden Caulfield. I mean, he's an instant archetype. But he's also just a deeply frustrating character to read sometimes.
He really is, a walking contradiction.
Totally. Judgmental, cynical, but then underneath, hopelessly vulnerable. Desperate for connection.
But pushing people away constantly.
Right. He wants authenticity, but rejects anyone who actually offers him something real. That famous hatred of phoniness, the pretense, the hypocrisy. It's not just like a philosophy.
No, it's like armor.
Exactly. It's an armor-plated shield covering up this deep, deep vulnerability.
And if you trace that vulnerability back, you land squarely on Allie, his brother.
Allie, yeah. Huh. The sources are clear. The core trauma is Allie's death. His younger brother died of leukemia.
And Holden preserves him in his mind as this perfect, untainted symbol of innocence.
The poems on the baseball mitt.
Right.
Written in green ink. Such a powerful image.
It really is.
And that unresolved grief, that paralysis around it, that's the root of Holden's breakdown now. Allie's death has sort of emotionally frozen him.
Leaving him unable to process loss, change, or just the imperfections of living people.
Yeah, it's why he demands this impossible perfection from everyone.
So that emotional instability, that's the fuel that really kicks the story off. He gets expelled from Pensy Prep.
His fourth school, right.
Fourth school. But the expulsion itself isn't quite the immediate trigger for him running off. It's that fight over Jane Gallagher.
Right, Jane. He has this incredibly idealized image of her, this pure figure from his childhood.
And his roommate, Ward Stradlater, the superficial jock type, goes on a date with her.
And Holden just explodes. He can't stand the thought of Stradlater's, you know, secret sloppiness possibly tainting Jane.
It's like his first big failure to protect innocence from the adult world.
It is. And so bruised, alone, he just impulsively takes off days early, yelling, "Sleep tight, you morons," as he leaves Pensy.
It's the sound of him running away.
Absolutely. Right. Running from a world he feels powerless against.
And that impulsive exit throws him right into the chaos of New York City. Which just makes the loneliness worse somehow.
Oh, exponentially. He gets there, checks into the Edmont Hotel, which is pretty rundown.
And immediately starts judging everyone.
Yes. The perverts and morons he sees from his window. But what strikes me is the immediate disconnect in his own behavior.
How so?
He tries to act like an adult, lying to that woman on the train, trying to order drinks in the lavender room.
But he can't pull it off.
Not at all. He's trying on these adult costumes, basically, and just finding them phony on himself, too.
And the psychological low point of that first night has to be the encounter with Sunny the prostitute.
Oh, yeah. And Maurice, her pimp. The sources really emphasize that Holden hires Sunny not really for sex, but, yeah, he's just so lonely. He just wants someone to talk to.
Which tells you so much about him right there.
It reveals this deep, painful truth. He's confused about sex, maybe terrified by it. And he just cannot bridge the gap between his sort of romantic, idealized fantasies of intimacy.
And the harsh reality of this transactional adult world.
Yeah. And when Maurice and Sunny come back and basically rough him up and steal his money, that's his brutal introduction to real adult cruelty, exploitation.
It just confirms all his worst fears about the world, doesn't it?
Completely. It feeds right into his cynicism.
So moving into the next day, he tries to connect with Sally Hayes.
Hmm.
And this is just a masterclass in Holden's self-sabotage.
Oh, absolutely. The date starts with him hating everything. The play is phony. The people are phony. Sally's phony.
Yet he goes along with it.
He does. And then in this moment of just sheer, almost manic desperation,
yeah,
he begs Sally to run away with him to a cabin somewhere remote, just live this idealized frozen adolescence forever.
It's the ultimate escape fantasy, isn't it? Just
yeah.
Stop time.
Totally. And Sally, quite reasonably, refuses because, I mean, the plan is nuts.
Of course.
And his frustration just boils over. He lashes out, calls her a royal pain in the ass, destroys the connection.
He pushes away the very thing he craves because it doesn't match his impossible ideal.
Exactly. It's a pattern.
If we step back a bit, look at the symbols.
Mm-hmm.
The sources point to two key things that reveal his state of mind. First, the ducks in Central Park.
Ah, the ducks. Yes, he's obsessed with them.
He keeps asking cab drivers, where did the ducks go in the winter?
It shows his anxiety about change, doesn't it? About survival. Do things lost, like Allie, just disappear forever? Or do they somehow come back?
And that anxiety is contrasted with his love for the Museum of Natural History.
Right. The museum is his safe space because the exhibits are frozen and immutable, as he says. They never change.
Unlike people.
Yeah.
Or ducks.
Exactly. He says, and this is like the core of his whole problem, certain things, they should stay the way they are.
It highlights this intense, almost paralyzing fear of change, which makes sense given the trauma of Allie's death. He wants the world to just stop.
Yeah. He can't handle the unpredictability of life.
So by this point, he's really hitting bottom. Physically sick, emotionally drained, completely alone.
Which forces him towards the only truly authentic relationship he has left, Phoebe. He sneaks back into his parents' apartment to see his 10-year-old sister. She's his anchor, isn't she?
Absolutely. She's witty, insightful. She sees right through his act.
And she confronts him, calls him out on his failures, his drifting, points out he never finishes anything.
And her challenge pushes him to finally say it, to articulate that strange driving wish he has.
Which brings us right to the heart of it, the central metaphor, the catcher in the rye.
He tells Phoebe about mishearing that Robert Burns poem.
Right, he thinks it's if a body catch a body coming through the rye.
And he pictures himself standing at the edge of this crazy cliff, saving children playing in a field of rye, saving them from falling into the phony adult world.
It's just heartbreaking, isn't it? This messianic complex he has. He wants to save everyone else from the fall because he couldn't save Allie.
That quote, I have to catch everybody if they start to go over the cliff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the title, the thesis, everything.
It defines his impossible mission, this self-imposed martyrdom.
But even when he seeks sanctuary after that, he faces one last deeply unsettling encounter with Mr. Antolini.
Ah, yes. His former teacher, who seems genuinely kind, offers him a place to stay, gives him some really insightful advice.
But then the terror. Holden wakes up, finds Mr. Antolini stroking his head.
And the ambiguity there is just Salinger's genius. Was it predatory? Was it just a clumsy, fatherly gesture?
It almost doesn't matter what Antolini intended.
Exactly. What matters is Holden's perception. For him, it feels like the ultimate betrayal. The last safe adult space is violated.
It confirms his worst fears again and triggers his final panicked flight.
It really does.
But if we look at Antolini's advice itself, before that moment, it offers this philosophical counterpoint to Holden's catcher fantasy.
He quotes Wilhelm Stickel, the psychoanalyst.
Right. The mark of the immature man is that he wants to die nobly for a cause, while the mark of the mature man is that he wants to live humbly for one.
That's the challenge to Holden, isn't it? Antolini is essentially saying maturity isn't about grand, self-destructive gestures.
It's about the hard, messy work of actually living, contributing, not just running away or being a martyr.
Yeah. Living humbly for a cause.
But Holden initially ignores this, right?
Yeah.
He decides on his most extreme escape yet.
The deaf-mute plan. Run away out west, cut off all communication, all connection, forever.
A total withdrawal. But that self-destructive path gets stopped by Phoebe again.
She shows up with her little suitcase packed, ready to go with him, demanding to join him.
And that act of pure selfless devotion, it just shocks him.
It forces him to see, maybe for the first time, that his actions have real consequences for the people he loves, the one person he truly cherishes.
And that realization leads directly to the climax, really. The resolution of the carousel.
Ah, the carousel scene. It's beautiful.
He takes Phoebe to the zoo and watches her riding the carousel in the pouring rain.
Reaching for that brass ring, taking a risk, accepting she might fail, might fall.
And watching her, Holden feels this moment of just pure, profound happiness.
It's his moment of acceptance, finally.
He realizes he can't be the catcher, he can't prevent the risk, prevent the fall. He has to let Phoebe, let others try and grow, reach for their own ring.
He accepts the motion, the change. Finds peace not in the frozen museum, but in the, you know, the chaotic, joyful risk of the carousel, life itself.
And Salinger wraps it up so perfectly, bringing us back to the sanatorium frame.
Yeah, the ending is still bittersweet, though. He isn't magically cured.
No, it's just the beginning of maybe a long healing process. His final lines are still so ambiguous.
Don't ever tell anybody anything. If you do, you start missing everybody. Yeah. It captures that lingering conflict.
And the lasting power, I think, comes down to that voice. That incredible, authentic, colloquial voice Salinger created.
Absolutely. Peppered with all that 1950s slang phony, it killed me. Crumbie. It makes Holden feel so real, like a friend telling you his story.
And the red hunting hat. We have to mention the hat.
Oh, yeah. It was never just a hat, was it? It was his armor, his flag of individuality, a shield against the world.
So what does this all mean? What's the takeaway?
I think the novel just endures because Holden's voice gives words to that timeless paradox, you know? We desperately want authenticity, connection.
In a world that often seems to reward the exact opposite artifice, conformity.
Precisely.
So the legacy, I guess, is that Catcher in the Rye validates the struggle of being young, that alienation, the grief, the search for meaning.
Yeah.
It treats them as profound, legitimate experiences.
Yeah, it shows that the transition away from innocence is agonizing because you realize you have to choose. Choose between that fantasy of perfection.
And the messy, humbling, often disappointing reality of adult life.
Holden's journey resonates because, in some way, it's a journey we all have to take.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.